You're listening to Extinct, a podcast about dead things. I'm Alice Leggett. Together, we'll explore the stories of species that have existed over millions of years, from the earliest forms of life to those that died out more recently, as well as modern biodiversity loss and conservation initiatives. Hello, you're listening to Extinct. In this episode, we're looking into the sudden mass death of over 40 million mangrove trees in northern Australia's Gulf of Carpentaria over summer in 2015 and 2016. Mangrove deaths were seen along 2,000 kilometres of the country's coastline, equating to more than 76 square kilometres of trees lost. This resulted in around 1 million tonnes of carbon being released and damage to other coastal ecosystems. A similar die-off event occurred in 1982, the scale of which is unknown. We have Dr. Norman Duke from James Cook University to tell us more about this die-off event. Dr. Duke has more than 40 years' experience as a mangrove ecologist and has worked on a range of research projects focusing on tidal wetland ecosystems. Dr. Duke heads the James Cook University Mangrove Hub and has been studying the mangrove die-off, which he says is the worst in global recorded history. Dr. Duke has been involved in research that has since determined why so many mangroves were lost. Norm, thank you so much for joining us. To get things started, how did you get involved in studying mangroves and mangrove ecology?
Early in my career, after leaving university, my first job was in marine science. I mean, this was the dream job for me, was to work in marine science. And my first real job was a year-long study of the trawl fisheries in Torres Strait. But it was only a year long, and near the end of that year, I applied for and got a position at the brand spanking new Australian Institute of Marine Science. That's in Townsville. And that job was to conduct research on coral reef ecosystems. Wow. I mean, that was just what I really loved doing. But I had to turn it down because I was committed to a final survey in Torres Strait and because Ames needed someone straight away. But the people at Ames said, oh, look, you know, we need that sort of skill set. So they referred me to the next available job coming up, and that was with Inshore Productivity. And that group was the one that would work on coastal ecosystems and particularly mangroves. So in that was a life-changing or directional or career-changing direction. I found a niche in my studies of mangrove ecosystems, which I've been conducting now for over 50 years and become specialised in this habitat and I guess all things about that habitat. So, yeah, that was the life-changing moment.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, you sometimes, especially when you're right out of uni, you think you want one thing and then you get into something a bit different and it ends up being your thing. So I think it's wonderful that you got into mangroves because there's so much to learn about the mangrove ecosystems. But to frame the severity of this big die-off event, why are mangroves important for coastal ecosystems and what sort of role do they play?
As we know, mangroves have multiple benefits. I'd have to say that most, though, are poorly appreciated if they're even noticed at all. You'll be aware, though, most people are aware of the benefits of mangroves to coastal fisheries and the productivity of the coast. But added to this, there's these other protections that mangroves offer of shorelines from storms, boat wake, tsunami waves, sea level rise, and extreme sea level oscillations. And added to that, you can include things like carbon sequestration and storage, habitat for marine and terrestrial species, and they're also known as the kidneys of the coast. Essentially, that means that they're responsible for improving coastal water quality that allows corals and seagrasses to grow on these shorelines, which otherwise they would not. As such, they provide a coastal defence barrier and buffer. And they're also known as the shoreline guardians, as they facilitate and enhance the growth of these neighbouring ecosystems that I talked about. For example, if you think of Great Barrier Reef with its coral ramparts and reefs and such, they would not be where they are along our coastline today if it wasn't for the mangroves that sat along the coastline and were buffering them from the coastal runoff that we see. So they have a very important role as the interface ecosystem between land and sea. And in that context, we're talking about the marine ecosystems as the ecosystem that they're protecting and nurturing. Mangroves are linked to sea level in their growth location all around the world. Normally, they grow between mean sea level, which is half in the middle of the tidal range, right? So you've got high tide, you've got low tide. Well, mean sea level is slap bang in the middle, but they only grow above mean sea level to the high water mark naturally. That's their entire range. That could be literally a meter or less of elevation range. And if that zone moves, and that's why they're compromised or vulnerable to sea level rise. And that's probably the big thing to point out, how mangroves are so fixed to the shoreline elevation and obviously the sea level that's inundating that coastline. And it points out this essentially basic vulnerability of tidal wetland ecosystems.
Given their multifunction purpose, it shows why we need to be caring about the mangroves. But with the die-off that we've seen, how was the scale of this actually measured? What sort of research processes were involved in this?
It's a very interesting beginning in this project and looking at this particular die-off event in 2015 in Northern Australia. Essentially, the first indications were messages sent from community members in the Gulf region sending me images and notes about mangroves dying in large areas. And the photos were particularly telling, particularly from aerial photographs or taken from aircraft. And it was simply gobsmacking. These images were, I was going to a conference at the time and I had arrived at the conference. I had another talk prepared, but I gave it away to talking about what people have been sending me. It was that impressive. And indeed, all the mangrove experts were meeting in Darwin at the time. And as I presented the imagery and made the commentary about the extent of dieback that I was being told about, there was just silence, sort of like the crowd was obviously shocked by what they were seeing. And we're talking about observations from individuals who were not talking or were not in communication with each other. And they were, up to about 1,000 kilometres apart. And they were sending the same story and the same messages about mass dieback. And clearly, we were on the threshold of a very important and significant event. Nothing like it had been observed before, where there was synchronous dieback of mangroves across more than 1,000 kilometres of shoreline. The way that the research that followed was that, I'm going to check on this. And the idea with those follow-up observations, when I had the chance to start that, we used satellite imagery to map the newly dead mangroves and use that satellite imagery to both measure the area and map the extent. And that's the beginning of the study. And after that, we conducted ground studies and a lot more kinds of studies. But I think as the first processes about measuring the scale that's captured in those satellite images.
For people who haven't seen the satellite images, I highly recommend having a look because they really show the scale of this problem. It's quite confronting seeing visually what it looks like when an ecosystem just dies randomly all at once. So they are definitely worth having a look at. But with this die-off event, it's obviously very significant. But what do you think caused it?
Firstly, I've got to say that the scale was reinforced further because once we convinced I got in first to borrow time on helicopters that were flying in the region before we had dedicated funding. And we flew the coastline in different areas, covering about 600 kilometres initially in three different locations around the Gulf of Carpentaria. And we could reinforce the imagery views because the satellite imagery tells you one thing, but there's nothing more graphic than oblique aerial photography, looking along a coastline and seeing dead mangroves for 20 or 30 kilometres just disappearing off in the blue. But okay, as to the cause, well, that was obviously the very important question, and that's the one that we got funding or convinced the federal government through the National Environmental Science Program to give us funding to find out what the cause was, because was it related to what people were doing close at hand, immediate effects like that, like an oil spill or something like that, or was this something new completely? And it turns out to be something new. And what we now know caused the dieback was that it was, strangely enough, a period of 6 months where sea levels were almost half a metre lower than they normally were because of the conditions of the El Niño at the time. That's in 2015. So what caused the dieback was the mangroves died of thirst. There was desiccation because these mangroves are not being wetted with the high tide of the day because they are half a metre lower. But since starting this study, we've learnt that such an event at the time was considered unprecedented, but we discovered there was an earlier event in 1982 as well that did more or less the same thing. The observations, aerial imagery, et cetera, extremely rare or not as available as now. So we're talking about just 30-odd years. You know, we've come a long way with satellite imagery and aerial imagery, et cetera, certainly in these remote parts of the country. So as it turns out, those 2 years are the 2 years of the worst El Niños on record. And as we found out, that there's a direct link between the El Niño severity and sea level. And I should mention that El Niños tend to be quantified or measured in terms of what's called the Southern Oscillation Index, the SOI. And this is just the ratio of barometric pressures from Tahiti to Darwin. But that simplistic measure is incredibly powerful. And of course, it's what's used today to measure El Niños and La Niña conditions, and I can define those further. But my point at the moment is that these changes in the ocean atmosphere and so forth, those processes are affecting mangroves through their effects on sea level and so forth. And as we've recorded, this mass dieback events in exact correlation with the periods of El Niño conditions. And we know about the relative severity of El Niño through time because recorded in coral cores, we can see the record of El Niños going back 400 years. So we know that the events that we witnessed in 1982 and 2015 are actually unusual, unprecedented over that time period. And we also know that, well, just to broaden the point a bit further, we also know that these El Niño events were also matched with the severity or the most severe periods of coral bleaching. So it's not the only coastal marine habitat to be affected by these processes. It's just that we haven't really appreciated before that these effects on sea level oscillations have these profound effects on coastal marine ecosystems.
Is this die-off in line with natural cycles, or is this unusual, and how do these weather events play into this?
Well, those weather events that I referred to related to El Niño and La Niña, most people by now appreciate that there's this very distinct correlation between weather events, whether it be lots of rain or high temperatures and so forth. They can see the influence on weather and climate. And what's interesting is that we also need to make these links between these El Niño or La Niña conditions with sea level as well for those habitats in coastal areas. Obviously, well, sea level effects are not going to have a huge influence on rainforests, for example, but obviously for mangroves, which are intimately associated with sea level, then the effects are going to be huge. And of course, I've mentioned that the El Niño conditions have low sea levels, and mangroves die of desiccation and basically dried conditions. And so we call that desiccation. But during the periods of La Niña, we get very high sea levels. And as it turns out, mangroves die in those conditions, but less dramatically because they don't cover the same sort of range and distance. But in patches, there's certainly effects too when the sea levels are high. And of course, with high sea levels, we've also got rising sea levels because of sea level rises generally associated with global warming. So we've got these influences that are going on that are massive and that's linked to, yes, weather events generally, but it's also linked to the effects of sea level on sea level as well. I should mention that the other weather event that has incredibly important influences as well is tropical cyclones. And I've just done an assessment of tropical cyclones for the Great Barrier Reef region. And in the last decade, if we're talking about the last six decades, the last most recent decade, the severity of cyclones has increased dramatically and also the frequency. So if you match that sort of observation with the other observation we've made, and that is that as severity of cyclones increases, the damage to mangroves goes up exponentially. So because it's directly dependent on wind speed, sort of damage is inflicted on a mangrove forest as a cyclone crosses them. So that influences not only the area of mangroves, but clearly in the post-damage recovery, mangroves, well, they take a certain amount of time to recover from specific levels of damage. We can actually measure that because of the satellite imagery measures that we have. We can look at how long it takes. It takes about 20 odd years before mangrove forests recover generally from damage, but of course it differs with the severity of damage. But the problem with this process is that as you get more severe damage, and if that severity just keeps on increasing, the capacity of mangroves to replace themselves is compromised by the fact that their innate processes are driven by just what all trees have to do, is basically put down young trees as seedlings, and then the trees have got to grow, and it takes decades to get them to grow to a size where they are able to. And those growth rates are sort of finite. They can't get faster. They can't grow any faster. So their capacity to, I suppose, repair the damage, if that damage is, I suppose, limited. So unfortunately, we've got one side of the equation getting increasingly worse, where the capacity to recover is fixed. And so at some point, that allows us to predict when those mangroves will finally be unable to replace themselves.
It's sad looking at it in terms of almost knowing when the end is to an extent, but we'll get into if there's anything we can do about it. But with the actual causes of it, in contrast, Macquarie University's Neil Saintelin has proposed that the moon's orbital patterns and the subsequent impacts on tides contributed to the die-off. What do you think of this?
Well, there's no doubt that anything that influences sea level in the ways I've been talking about are going to have an effect. There's a lot of things contributing. For example, for the dieback of mangroves, if there was rainfall like there is on most of the East Coast, then the moisture is not in deficit. Okay, so the mangroves don't die in those conditions, even though the sea levels might be lower. They're getting wetting from other sources. So the story is about the location and the extent of mangroves, and I guess the factors that are actually causing them to die, rather than things like wobbly moon orbit and affecting tides, because this is not about only the tides. This is about sea level itself and about the barometric pressures across the Pacific Ocean. And that when we get high sea levels or low sea levels, let's say on the Australian East Coast, over on the other side, Panama, Ecuador, Colombia, those coastlines on the other side of the Pacific are actually getting the exact opposite. So we're getting half a meter drop in sea level. They're getting a half a meter higher. So you're seeing the whole Pacific Ocean is wobbling around. Now, at this stage, we can see that this is clearly related to processes that are affecting the El Nino Southern Oscillation processes. They call them ENSO. And it really doesn't matter what other peripheral of those processes might be affecting this. So with Neil Saintelin's deductions, I was just concerned that his team did not take into account the 1982 occurrence, as well as the 2015 occurrence of mass dieback in the Gulf of Carpentaria. And they didn't take into account that this effect was felt across all of northern Australia. In other words, mangroves showed dieback all the way from Exmouth, you know, around Darwin, all the way around to the Gulf of Carpentaria. they're just not going down the East Coast. And it just so happens that the East Coast, I believe, it didn't occur there because of the rainfall occurring during those winter periods when the sea levels were low. So I think there's a bigger picture here and so forth. Lunar wobbler alone is not the responsible agent, if any, in this process.
With the dieback, what sort of impact has this loss had in the short term? What sort of long-term impacts are we potentially looking at here?
In the short term, the impact is a loss of forests and a loss of habitat. We're talking about 80 square kilometres of dead mangroves, okay? 80 square kilometres, that's 8,000 hectares of dead mangroves. And we're talking about 30 or so million trees have died. And all those trees had been sequestering carbon, putting it below ground, holding it below ground and storing it. In other words, they're contributing to obviously getting carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. They're all gone. And the other things that are lost, of course, is all that shoreline protection that those mangroves and clearly the habitat to mud crabs, fisheries, etc. So we expect, but they don't have any clear answers about that relationship between mangroves and the fisheries. But the general consensus is that there must be a huge effect out there impacting, well, I suppose people's budgets and those who are in fishery industries are going to be really concerned about the loss of or any disruptions to supply of, I suppose, commercial fish species. And so there's those direct losses, immediate losses that we're talking about, because simply because of the loss of the habitat, you do whatever reason, if it's gone, then clearly all the benefits are going to disappear. But as a long-term strategy, or I suppose the consideration, you take that into effect, we're looking at the mangrove function where it's protecting the shoreline. And this role in view of rapidly rising sea levels. I mean, we're talking about rising sea levels in the Gulf of Carpentarian, in Torres Strait, in these parts of northern Australia. It's like 8 millimetres a year of sea level rise. And that's generally high in global average rates of rising sea levels. And if we've got a coastline that's damaged and mangroves are obviously vegetation on a shoreline, they're protecting it from erosion and change. And clearly, where these protective environments are removed, then, of course, the shoreline's going to be inundated and eroded much more rapidly than it would if the trees are there, sort of slowing down the process. They can't stop it, of course. Sea level rise is a normal function over geological time around the world. So mangroves are particularly good. They're very good at regrowing. And that's one of their special attributes, is that they are incredibly adapted to replacing themselves. So they have advanced seedlings, which are what they call viviparous, which means they're living on the parent tree. So in other words, mangroves grow these very special seedlings on the parent trees. They don't wait around with seeds and stuff. For most of the mangrove species, they grow viviparous propagules, which are living already. So they've basically got their track shoes on, they're ready to start running as soon as they hit the ground. There's no other plants that do that. And mangroves, even though they're from multiple different types of plants, they've adapted themselves to rapid recolonization and regrowth, specifically, I believe, because of this need to relocate as sea levels rise and fall over geological time. So mangroves have been around for 50 million years. They're survivors. They're very good at this. But now we see that they're potentially compromised because the rate of change and the types and the severity of change or accumulative change or pressures are likely to overwhelm them. And that's what we're worried about. And that by all accounts so far, this is the trajectory we appear to be on at the moment. We're rapidly approaching the threshold where mangroves are unable to survive anymore.
It's sad to think about that, but speaking of the hardiness of mangroves, what's the recovery from this mass die-off event been like? And what's the trajectory looking like for improvement with this and regrowth?
That's a really important question. And when we discovered that there was an event in 1982, we immediately had a means to have some insight into how to answer that question, because obviously we're just faced with dieback now and we'd be all speculating on what is potential. But because we had 1982, there's been enough years, 30-odd years easily, in that time period where these mangroves have had the opportunity to regrow, and they indeed have. In that time period, the shorelines have become re-established in many locations. Well, I know proportionally, we can see what recovery looks like and we can put a timeline. It takes about 20 years for mangroves, at least in that 1982 incident, for about 20 years for that shoreline to recover. I suppose the density of vegetation that would match its capability of providing all the benefits that we're talking about, shoreline protection and habitat and so forth. But the current circumstances are where the questions start to come. And those questions surround what's different now than what was going on in 1982. And we can easily look at this and see that, well, okay, the rates of sea level rise for a start are much faster in 2015 onwards. We also know something, at least not been quantified, but we know that after the 2015 event, the sites in the Gulf were hit by at least four dramatic newsworthy events which are damaging to mangrove forests. And two of them were severe tropical cyclones. That means cyclones category 3 and bigger. So in 2018, there was severe tropical cyclone Owen, which probably wiped out about 200 or 300 kilometres of shoreline mangroves in that one event. And as it turns out, there was a lot of dead mangroves that cyclone swept up that had died in 2015. And the sad thing about that cyclone, and indeed others, is that the dead wood that's been swept up from the earlier dieback event was actually used as projectiles with tidal movement and waves, et cetera, during the storm to bulldoze, I guess, the recovery that had been trying to take place. You know, young seedlings that had got established and saplings, et cetera, that were growing, and indeed even the trees that had survived and were re-sprouting were all swept away by the cyclone. And then there was another cyclone in 2019. That was Tropical Cyclone Trevor. It's a Category 4 cyclone, so extremely severe, and has been very rare to have such severe cyclones. And the damage from that was just significantly greater and covered probably 600 kilometres of shoreline in that instance. So we got the cyclones, and then we've got something else, and that was the dramatic floods of 2019. And we had the dramatic floods just recently, earlier this year, late last year, where we had flooding. Well, 2019, the river was, 70 kilometres wide, flowing into the Gulf of Carpentaria. Obviously, there's nothing like that in normal times. It's usually arid, etc. But to have this massive floods, there are huge consequences that come out of these large-scale events. And, of course, the mangroves are damaged by these occurrences. So what's the recovery? Well, clearly, there are instances that did not occur after 1982 to that extent. And already it's sort of matching the idea that the damage is more severe this time and recovery is being compromised in ways where it's not following the trajectory that we can see for the 1982 event. So there's concern that if the mangroves don't get re-established, then these shorelines will be eroded and washed away, the soft sediments and low-lying coastlines. So there will be significant saline intrusion. And with the sea's action, there'll be erosion. So it's going to be more turbidity in the water, as well as change of the tidal profile of the day. So there's going to be coastal retreat, essentially. And they're the sorts of things that really are the focus of future research and much needed.
With this recovery process as well, is there any action that can be taken that you think would improve the recovery?
Well, I do. I see management of mangrove forests essentially in three levels. The first level is to do things to limit the impacts of climate change, as in controlling emissions, CO2 levels in the atmosphere, etc. That's a well-known strategy that needs to be conducted at a national level. But at a local level, there's at least two things that can be done. One is that we need to, I suppose, improve the resilience. That means the health and the well-being of mangrove tidal wetlands systems. In other words, we need to be looking at them to find out what are the things that are causing them not to grow so fast or to be limited in some ways. And there's quite a few. In northern Australia, around the Gulf of Carpentaria, for example, or anywhere across northern Australia, there are significant problems that we have evidence of having impacts. And one of them is feral pigs, which dig up along the high water mark around mangroves, digging up the small animals that live in mangroves, the crabs, the worms, and even the roots of the trees that are, well, the young trees that are growing. And of course, they're digging it up and walking around. It kills the young seedlings that are trying to grow there. And as I was talking about before, with rising sea levels, mangroves have to move into these high intertidal locations if they're going to survive. And these pigs are stopping that process. But they're not alone as the agents of harm here. There's also grass fires which come burning to the edge of the mangrove forest. They don't burn into the mangrove forest generally when they're being wetted by the tides. But what we do notice is that along the edges, again at this high intertidal edge, the scorching from the fire is enough to kill the seedlings that are growing along that edge. So again, there's another thing causing harm to the zone that has to expand, or if it's not allowing the mangroves to retreat inland. And of course, the other one is exotic weeds. There's rubber vine and other exotic weeds that smother that coastal edge of trees, including mangroves. And so they're causing harm too. Those three things, just as examples, you can do something about at a local level. And we have worked with the traditional owners, with their ranger groups, to advise on some of this. They know already most of these things, but it's in the context. We can give them a context of how and why this needs to be done on the edge of the mangroves. Removing feral pigs, removing the weeds, and having more controlled burns instead of sort of uncontrolled fires along that edge is important. So those things are important because we've identified things that are damaging or harming the mangroves and stopping them doing what they must do to survive. And this is all things that will increase their resilience so that they can accommodate and adapt to the changes taking place. And what the mangroves are trying to do, just in summary, is they're trying to move inland as the sea levels rise. Otherwise, because the mangroves are being lost at the sea edge as the sea levels rise, at some point, if they don't move inland, of course, the mangroves eventually get squeezed out of existence. But we've also got where we feel that we can do something about it. So if we can reduce the impact when it comes, then we can actually save thousands of hectares. And every hectare we save, we're going to be just get them over that threshold moment when they would have died. We're saving habitat. We're saving all those benefits that mangroves give. And the way to do that is clearly where we understand that it's moisture that becomes limiting. So what has been proposed is that we could go out and literally water the mangroves at a critical time. And we only have to do that once, I believe. And we can keep them alive just that bit longer till the wet season comes and they can go on from there, because it's just going to be like one event to save these trees. So how would you do that? Well, I suggest you could do that in the way that, well, I suppose like people fighting fires or something, or crop dusters or something that sprinkle water over areas of mangrove that are obviously desiccated. But the other point with that is that you have to know when to do it to be practical and useful. You have to know that the sea levels are low, etc. And as it turns out, there is a lag between when we can actually see when sea levels are low of a month or so, and we can see that mangroves start dying after that month. So we could be monitoring these sea levels, and when we know that they've gone beyond the threshold, then we know we've got to do something. The benefits would be that we could save, we only have to save several hectares to have an advantage. And there might be places where we can be selective about that if we can't cover the whole area that's affected, for example, in the Gulf of Carpentaria. So one strategy is to propose sort of this large-scale watering program to be delivered at critical times. I believe we could put that to good use and have some significant management outcomes if we managed to be able to do that.
It's good to know that there are practical things that can be done to address this. It makes the situation feel a lot less hopeless.
Yeah, well, the thing is that people have proposed planting, and which has always been the knee-jerk response to restoration of mangroves, but planting is not the weak link in mangroves. Mangroves are very good at planting themselves and producing propagules. So obviously, there are some places where supplementing the supply can be useful, but in the Gulf of Carpentaria, the supply was not compromised because we lost 10% of mangroves during that event in 2015, we know. So there's 90% of mangroves still doing what they do. And every year they'll be producing tons of viable living seedlings ready to strike out, etc. So there's no shortage of supply in this case. So planting is not the answer. And that's why we have to be a bit more creative and innovative in actually a strategy that can address this kind of dieback. Other kinds of dieback, there'd be other strategies. Perhaps there's other kinds of processes involved. So I think it's important to, you know, to have that insight and understanding of what's going on, understand the processes, understand why the mangroves have died, make sure that that particular thing is not still present, like if it was a pollutant of some kind that was toxic, like herbicides or something, you'd have to understand if that could naturally leave the system somehow so that it was no longer causing an effect. We have to understand the processes of sea level rise, you know, meaning that there's pressure on mangroves being lost at the seaward edge naturally, but they have to be able to accommodate and grow new seedlings up at the high intertidal to migrate the tidal wetland zone inland to survive. So there's a whole lot of things that need to be wired into people considering rehabilitation or building of shorelines or restoring shorelines. They must have a consideration for the long-term changes taking place. One thing I wanted to raise with you that I'm more and more fascinated about mangrove forests and growing along the semi-arid and arid coastlines is that what's recognisably distinct about mangroves is that they form closed canopy forests of trees, that means, in areas where the terrestrial habitat may not even have trees. I mean, the conditions of living near the sea or adjacent to the sea, alongside the sea, the mangroves have made full use of that sea influence, right, to allow and adapted to it. So they're very special trees. It really is incredibly noticeable when you do the aerial surveys or even look at the satellite imagery of desert areas and you look at that shoreline and you see this little fringe of green, solid green fringe of trees. I mean, that's really special because you don't get that on the land. Then it's entirely about moisture availability. And it's just that mangroves are able to use salt water to maintain their condition. It's, I suppose, default condition allows them to grow as these forests. It's really, really special and worth pointing out is this dependence on sea level.
It's extraordinary, their resilience in the face of that when no other plants are able to thrive there. You can still find mangroves, they're still present in these areas.
Yeah, but what we've got to remember is that they do that in a, what I call a Goldilocks zone, right, of the sea level conditions. And when the sea level conditions, in other words, they get too extreme or are high or low, then there are consequences, right? And normally, over hundreds of years, this has remained, you know, haven't got to those extremes. So the mangroves have been able to survive in this fringe of green. But now what we're finding in these recent events is that they're being cropped and damaged during those extreme event conditions. So the sea level, once now as it gets bigger and bigger oscillations, in other words, there's mean sea level, which is going up, but then it's not a straight line. It's wavering around that line or oscillating around that line. And obviously those oscillation events are becoming more and more severe as the climate or the atmospheric conditions become more energized with the higher temperatures. And so the picture gets complicated in that way. And clearly for the Gulf of Carpentaria or even Northern Australia generally, with mangroves dying because of low sea levels, sounds sort of counterintuitive in the conditions where sea levels are rapidly rising. So we've got to be prepared to understand how those things are working.
that totally makes sense, and hopefully they won't be squeezed out of existence. Norm, the final question I had for you here was, looking into the future and knowing that the significant event happened in 2015, then of course the one in 82 as well, but looking into the future, do you think that more mangrove die-off events are likely to be seen both Australia and across the globe?
Again, you're right on beam with the question. Yes, is the simple answer. We already are seeing examples of unexplained dieback. And essentially that's what happened in the Gulf, remember? It was unexplained, but we've been able to explain it because we've done the studies where you can make the links with the causal agents. But there are other instances. I mean, one example of unexplained dieback at the moment is in the Gulf of Panama on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, where their mangrove dieback was observed in 2015 or just after. Isn't that interesting? I mean, that was the same year or period when we had the mass dieback in Australia. But the dieback in Australia was from low sea levels. So knowing what we know about the sea levels across the Pacific, then we already know, I suppose, that the sea levels on the Gulf of Panama, which is that Pacific coast of the Americas, those sea levels were higher. And they appear to be higher to the same amount. So was this an incident that was caused by these high sea levels? Well, I mean, that's one question. Or was it a combination of those high sea levels matched with some particular characteristics of the weather at the time? We need to know. We need to know what are the drivers of these mass event changes. And curiously, there's another mass event change going on in the Indian Ocean in the Maldive Islands, where across these islands, we're getting mass dieback of mangroves and unexplained again. So more questions. So there needs to be dedicated research to unravel these occurrences and to do the forensic investigation to find out what are the drivers of change in each instance of these things, so that they might easily be related, or if not the same, as what's happened in the Gulf of Carpentaria and across northern Australia in 2015 and 1982. So these events need to be studied, need to be explained. If we're going to fully understand the changes and their greater implications for the long-term survival of mangrove forests.
Yeah, certainly, definitely worth our long-term attention for this one, because the loss of mangroves will be both very sad, of course, but also devastating to our coastal ecosystem. So certainly one to watch for sure. Norm, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. It's been wonderful hearing your insights about this and hearing more about this problem.
You're welcome. Thank you, Alice.
You've been listening to Extinct. I'm Alice Leggett. If you want to hear more about dead things, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. And don't forget to leave a rating or review. It helps Extinct reach more people who are passionate about the planet's past and future. Until next time, stay curious.